Santana into the windup. The payoff pitch on the way. Swung out and missed. Strike three. He's done it. Johan Santana has pitched a no-hitter in the 8,020th game in the history of the New York Mets. They finally have a no-hitter. And who better to do it than Johan Santana? And what a remarkable story.
That was Howie Rose with the call on WFAN radio here in New York. You know, as a Mets fan, we have not had a lot to cheer for, a lot to celebrate over the last couple of years. It's just one thing after another with this team. But watching Johan Santana throw that no-hitter on Friday night was just a thing of beauty. And I had to share that awesome call with everybody, whether you're a baseball fan or not. I wanted to share that here at the top of the show. A proud Mets fan this weekend, I am. I don't get to say that very often, so when I actually do have a chance to celebrate this team in some way, I like to take that opportunity because you never know when the bottom will drop out. So that was a great night to be a fan on Friday night. A great weekend it has been. We're going to carry on the tradition of this great weekend with this great podcast. This is episode 221 of the Solomonster Sounds Off on SEScoops.com. It is Sunday, June 3rd. 2012. I also had a very nice trip to the city of Portland this week. I think I mentioned I was heading to the Beaver State last week. I was in Portland, Oregon this week. It was a very brief trip, but a beautiful city. I noticed lots of tattoos and piercings. Not quite sure what the reason is behind that. Looked more like the Lower East Side of Manhattan than some place I would expect to find in the state of Oregon. I was told that they have an expression there. Portland is apparently the city where young people go to retire. And I can believe it. Lots of dudes just kind of hanging around. Not much going on. There were also a lot of Miami Heat fans in Portland, as I guess the head coach for the Heat, Eric Spoelstra, actually grew up in Portland. So I thought that was kind of interesting. So good trip. Quick update here on last week's lead story regarding Brock Lesnar's appearance at UFC 146 and his subsequent meeting with UFC President Dana White. The only thing we know is that the two of them did meet after the show, and apparently that meeting did not go all that well. My guess, and this is just a guess, is that Dana White realized that Brock was clearly trying to get some heat for his WWE storyline and thought he was serious when he first took the meeting and thus did not take too kindly to that. But WWE didn't acknowledge any of this on TV, aside from Big Show making a dig at, quote, phony UFC fighters. And you'd think that if it was part of an angle of some kind, they would have mentioned it. So I don't know what the hell's going on. But that is where things stand on the Brock Lesnar front. Not much more to report other than that. The big news of the week, Randy Orton suspended for 60 days. WWE announced on Wednesday that Randy Orton has been suspended for his second violation of the WWE wellness policy. No word on which drug he was suspended for using, but there have been reports online suggesting that he was caught with marijuana in his system, which is not a suspension. That is a $2,500 fine. But as a result, they then tested him for other drugs, and he failed for a steroid called Dianabol. And those are unconfirmed reports, I must note. I don't know where they originated, but they are spreading like wildfire, so just take that for what it's worth. That would make Orton the third high-profile WWE superstar to be suspended within the last 6 weeks. These guys are dropping like flies. Rey Mysterio was suspended for 60 days back in April for his second wellness violation, and Orton's scheduled opponent for No Way Out, Chris Jericho, was suspended for 30 days after the Brazilian flag incident. Orton was suspended last time back in 2006, which he later admitted was because he got caught smoking pot in the locker room after somebody snitched him out. I don't think he ever found out who that was. This means he will not be eligible to return to action until July 30th at the earliest, which means he is off the No Way Out pay-per-view, he is off the Money in the Bank pay-per-view, and he is also not going to be able to appear at the 1,000th Raw show, which is significant because it takes place in his hometown of St. Louis, Missouri, which really sucks for him. And the pay-per-views are a bigger deal because he's going to lose out on a ton of money by missing those dates, but I would imagine that he would have had a prominent role on that Raw show in St. Louis, but he won't now. And it's also a good news, bad news deal for SmackDown because it essentially leaves Sheamus and Alberto Del Rio as top guys while, you know, Daniel Bryan is busy feuding with Punk and Kane and all of that kind of stuff. Again, SmackDown's roster as compared to Raw has always been kind of on the thin side. And that's going to be even more so now. But you can also look at it as a positive, you know, for guys like Cody Rhodes and Antonio Cesaro, guys that you might think would now have more time to shine, at least in theory. I say that because WWE has already scheduled John Cena for a bunch of SmackDowns going forward, so it may just be a case where Cena takes Orton's spot on TV, which doesn't really do anybody any good if he's just going to continue his feud with the Big Show on Fridays. You know, whoop-de-friggin-do. Seth Rollins is touring with the Raw brand this weekend. Richie Steamboat is touring with the SmackDown brand, so, you know, their call-ups to TV may not be too far off. My thoughts on Orton are pretty simple. If he had a drug in his system that was on the banned substance list, then he really fucked the company on this one. He's the number two or three star in the entire company at a time they can ill afford to lose any more main eventers. And it just puts the company in a real tough position also, because if you got guys like William Regal and Evan Bourne, who in the past, you know, they've been hesitant WWE has to do anything with because they're one strike away from termination. Those are two guys that have two strikes under their belt. Well, now you've got one of your top guys with strike number two. How do you trust Orton with the title in the future? You know, we're in a main event match at WrestleMania going forward. One more screw up and he's gone. And I'm not saying I'd book him in matches against Drew McIntyre for the rest of his career. He's a main event guy. He belongs in a top spot. But it sucks for WWE, and it sucks for him to put them in that position. And it sucks for the fans who already paid money to, you know, for a ticket to the upcoming house shows and the TV tapings, some of whom were there to see Randy Orton. Randy Orton has a lot of fans out there. And you know who also gets screwed by this? Dolph Ziggler, who had appeared based on Raw this past Monday night, was going to take Chris Jericho's spot at the pay-per-view and be programmed for a match with Orton. Now, what they do with Ziggler, I have no idea. Put him in a match with Jack Swagger, I suppose. You know, there's a match that'll do him a lot of good. So, you know, one stupid act, and I haven't heard that Orton is contesting this, or, you know, certainly publicly he has not made any comments about it, so we don't know, but you know, one stupid act can have a really negative impact on more than just the one person. It has a negative impact on the company, has a negative impact on the people who work in the company, has a negative impact on the fans, has a negative impact in that Linda McMahon is going to be running for Senate, and there's a whole thing going on right now. WWE really, you know, put their foot in their mouth. They're threatening journalists now, and in my opinion, Linda doesn't stand a chance, but you know, they're going full bore ahead trying to get her elected. And, you know, every time somebody gets suspended in the company, even though Linda loves to say, well, you know, I'm no longer the CEO and I have nothing to do with the wrestling end of the company, that may well be true, but this all reflects poorly on her. It reflects poorly on the family. So just a bad situation all around. And it'll be interesting if Orton does make a comment at some point and if we do get confirmation exactly what the drug was. Normally that stuff comes out. It may take a while. But, I mean, if it was a steroid like Dianabol or something like that, I mean, how stupid can you be, you know? You hear names like Dianabol and Decadorabalin, which was a big, you know, steroid of choice back in the day with guys like Hogan and, you know, back in that era. You would think stuff like that is so easily detected now that it's almost hard to believe somebody in the position of a Randy Orton would take something like that, which is why I'm a little bit skeptical about that report. But whatever he took, he shouldn't have taken it. He's out, and sucks for SmackDown, I think, because I just, as much as I would love to see them push some of the younger guys and actually do something, and maybe they will, I just think they're going to slot Cena on that show, and it's going to be more of the same, and it really doesn't do them any good. So that's the situation on Randy Orton. Now, in other news that makes me very sad, Don West has given notice that he will be leaving TNA shortly. He has been with the company from the very beginning in 2002 and would make a fine candidate for their new Hall of Fame, by the way. He was an announcer with Mike Tenay for most of his run, which included a heel turn. For the people who actually remember that, he had a brief run also as a manager. He managed Amazing Red for a while and was actually really good at it before they inexplicably decided to take him off TV. You know, here's a guy with charisma. You know, a guy who can sell ice to an Eskimo and probably could have helped get some younger guys over. And they decided that it wasn't working and they yanked it. Why? Well, obviously they had a bunch of fucking idiots running the company at that time. That's the only logical reason I can come up with. Anyway, when they signed Taz from WWE to be an announcer, that spelled the end of Don West in that role. Which sucked because after several years of being six levels of awful, He had actually improved to be a pretty damn good announcer. He was pretty damn good in that position, I gotta say. Instead, they promoted him to head of merchandising, which is actually his forte. That's what he had been doing before he came to TNA. I used to sometimes flip on Home Shopping Network at 1 o'clock in the morning and would see Don West hawking baseball cards and practically having a heart attack on the air. It was entertaining as all hell, even though I never did buy any baseball cards from him. But in the new position, West has just thrived, and TNA has done extremely well on merchandise at their house shows, thanks entirely to him. I mean, take it from me. You know, I was at the TNA... actually, I've been to several TNA house shows, but in particular, the one last year in Brooklyn. And Don West was out there, outside the ballpark, as people were all lined up. This guy, I think I talked about it on the show, I was worried for his health. His face was beet red, and it was July, so it's hot outside. He's standing out there, he's ranting, he's raving, he looked like he was going to collapse. The guy put everything into it, and all he was doing was selling, whatever it was, brown bag specials, you know, TNA DVD and T-shirt combos, and he was doing pretty good with it. He was a very intense personality, but he put everything he had, clearly, he put everything he had into it, and this could have a potentially major effect on TNA's business, I think, because Don West has kind of been out of the limelight. He hasn't been a character or an announcer on TV. People tend to even forget he's still with the company. But make no mistake, his role was an important one, and him leaving is a big deal. When I recorded Sound Off 127 and I gave an outline of what I would do if I were in charge of WWE, I listed several TNA talents that I would bring over to the company, and Don West was one of them. There's a reason for that. He's passionate and really, really good at what he does. And according to the latest Wrestling Observer newsletter, he is going to be taking over as the general manager of the Wenatchee Wild of the North American Hockey League, handling promotions and marketing for the team, more so than the other duties one would normally associate with the position of the GM of a baseball team or a hockey team or a basketball team. So, you know, to that I just say, here's wishing nothing but the best for the guy. I hope he has all the success in the world. Last year, as I mentioned, I attended the TNA baseball show in Brooklyn, New York, and had an opportunity to meet Don West and get my picture taken with him, and it's one of my favorite photos, actually. I also have in my possession a mangled cookie tray that was used on Bully Ray's head during his street fight with D-Von, signed by Don West immediately following the match. That is a souvenir that I will hold on to for quite some time. I mean, how many people can honestly say they have one of those? I may be the only one. So the Solemn Officer wishes Don West all the best in his future endeavors, and unlike other people who normally say that, I actually do mean it in this case. Staying on the subject of TNA, they had their first live Impact of the summer in their new time slot of 8 to 10 p.m., and I watched the entire thing. I actually really enjoyed this show and thought it was better than Raw. No major screw-ups either, aside from the company president getting the date of their next pay-per-view wrong by about 3 months. Sting and Bobby Roode had a good match to open the show with a clean finish, even if I'm not a fan of having the world champion submit cleanly in the middle of the ring without losing the title. I thought the Bully Ray Joseph Park stuff was pretty engaging. Both guys are just so good in their roles. The gut check stuff is pretty engaging as well. I think Taz is a much better fit in the role of judge than Ric Flair would have been, so that's a plus. But just a good show on the whole. Like I said, I actually enjoyed it more than Raw. It wasn't a perfect show, but it was enjoyable enough. Show opened with a non-title lumberjack match between Sting and Bobby Roode. Roode took a bump in the corner early in this match where he landed right on his head, and I shrieked. I literally shrieked out loud. I thought he may have broken his neck, but thankfully he did not. It went back and forth for a while. Sting got thrown to the outside a bunch of times, and the heel lumberjacks would all gang up on him and beat him up, but he'd fight back. And at one point, Sting did a dive over the ropes and onto the lumberjacks outside, which was a pretty gutsy move for a 54-year-old dude with a bum shoulder to be trying, so he's got my respect. He went for the Scorpion Deathlock. Bobby Roode turned it into a crossface, but Sting got the ropes. He tried for the Scorpion Deathlock again, and this time Roode tapped out, just like that. Hulk Hogan then lumbered out onto the stage. This guy can barely move. It is just so sad. And Hogan came out. He announced that it's Slammiversary. It would be Sting and Roode for the title. And the crowd reacted pretty good to the announcement, which surprised me since we already saw this match recently on pay-per-view, but I guess people just love Sting. And Sting's been gone for about a month, month and a half. So, you know what they say, absence makes the heart grow fonder. And I guess TNA fans in the Impact Zone are looking forward to that match at Slammiversary. So there you go. Next segment, we had Bully Ray come out and challenge Joseph Park Esquire to a fight. Joe Park was sitting in the audience yet again as a fan with his popcorn and soda, looking absolutely mortified at the thought of having to get into the ring with Bubba. And Bully said he comes from a whole family of cowards, does Joe Park, and this pissed him off. And Joe Park got into the ring, but he still didn't want to fight Bully Ray, at which point Bully decided that he wanted to change his plea from last week to guilty, as in he was guilty of beating up Joe Park's brother Chris, you know, Abyss, and leaving him for dead. I always wanted to do that. I was looking for an opportunity on this show to actually say it, and there you go. So that made me very happy there. I love the Joe Park character. I just think he's great, personally. I know it's not everybody's cup of tea, but I think it's one of the best characters, quite frankly, to come along in TNA in a long time. So anyway, this enraged Joe Park. He grabbed Bully, who proceeded to drop to his knees and threatened to sue Joe Park if he hit him, which is also what makes the Bully Ray character so great. He's a bully, and yet when push comes to shove and he feels threatened, he becomes a pussy, as many bullies do in real life. So that's what's so good about the character. This all resulted in Joe Park wanting a match with Bully, who said that he would agree to one, but at Slammiversary, not tonight. And I don't know when they do the big reveal that Joe Park is really Abyss. Maybe they do it at the pay-per-view, but I'm almost hoping they have some other twist to the story that keeps it going a little bit longer. The Joe Park character is like I said, unlike any other character they have in the company right now, and I really don't have that much interest in seeing Abyss back at all. So as far as I'm concerned, you can slap Abyss's face on a milk carton and let him stay missing forever, and I think that would be totally fine. Austin Aries beat Chris Sabin in a short match to retain his X Division title. Sabin looked really pissed when the match was over, so perhaps that is the sign of an imminent heel turn. I guess we'll find out. Match was really too short to mean anything, but the action was good while it lasted. They cut backstage to a segment that was taped earlier in the day with Hulk Hogan and Taz, of all people. This felt surreal, seeing the two of them face-to-face. Hogan thanked Taz for agreeing to become the new judge for the Gut Check Challenge. Taz said that he was probably going to piss a lot of people off by being himself, and Hogan said he did not care. Next up, we had another pre-taped Gut Check segment from backstage featuring Taz, Al Snow, and Bruce Pritchard sitting in a room evaluating Joey Ryan's performance from last week's show. I think it was Pritchard who said that Ryan looked like a 70s porn star reject, and he clearly did not like the guy. Snow said that he looked different, and so that was a good thing. Taz said that his problem with Joey Ryan was that after Ryan found out he was fighting Austin Aries, the X Division champion, he didn't look like he was ready to fight. I guess inferring that he was too into his gimmick and his character, and they made fun of his mannerisms, and they said that Joey Ryan would have to cut the promo of a lifetime tonight to impress the judges. I liked this whole segment, I did. But one thing that made me really uncomfortable was one of the judges talking about, I think it was Taz maybe, talking about Ryan, quote, staying in character during the segment last week. It's like, really? Do we need to openly talk about people playing characters on the actual wrestling show? You know, at least with something like Tough Enough, which was an expose on the wrestling business in and of itself. And I know some of the older guys, like back in the day, Triple H hated Tough Enough, because he felt it just pulled the curtain back too much. I don't know if his position on that has changed now, being that they brought Tough Enough back earlier this year. But, you know, Tough Enough is one thing because it's a separate standalone show. It doesn't air as part of Raw. You know what I mean? This is a segment on Impact, and talking about people playing characters and staying in character, I didn't like that at all. But aside from that, I did like the segment. Jeremy Borash, up next, said that the fans would be able to vote for D-Von's TV title challenger tonight, which was a nice FU to WWE, beating them to the punch before they go 3 hours in July and start doing their own interactive stuff with the fans. Four candidates were Mr. Anderson, Jeff Hardy, Rob Van Dam, and Robbie E. So only one heel, interestingly enough. And as soon as he announced Jeff Hardy, I already knew the outcome. You can't have a legit online poll with Jeff Hardy in it and expect him not to win. So that was a dead giveaway to me. Up next, we had Dixie Carter come out to her awful ring music to make an announcement that TNA is starting its own Hall of Fame and will announce the first inductee at Slammiversary on, and this is her words, not mine, September 10th. Yes, she got the date of the next pay-per-view wrong. Oops. Well, it happens to the best of them, I suppose. I'm still wondering how many poor saps actually showed up in Miami at Sun Life Stadium on April 21st, expecting to see The Undertaker. I certainly hope nobody did, but it wouldn't shock me. By the way, I figure the first Hall of Fame inductee will either be Jeff Jarrett or AJ Styles, would be my guess. And being that Jarrett is a heel, I would lean towards AJ, maybe getting the nod. If it were me, I'd induct Randy Savage just to stick it to WWE. And because even though Savage only made like one or two appearances for TNA, he deserves the recognition. And if WWE won't give it to him, TNA can do it, and they could talk about how they actually show respect for their legends or something like that. Yes, I am bitter that Vince McMahon let some petty little grudge get in the way of inducting the man before he died, so if you don't like it, fuck off. Anyway, where was I? Yes, Dixie. She then introduced Brooke Hogan, making her Impact Wrestling debut as the new head of the Knockouts division. She had a Beth Phoenix vibe going. I'll let you figure out what that means. She looked good, though. I mean, she had absolutely nothing of note to say other than to thank Dixie and the fans over and over and over again. I said on Twitter I would hate to be sitting at the table with her for Thanksgiving dinner. We'd be there for 4 hours thanking people before even touching the turkey. So before everyone gets on her case, I would say let's just give her a chance to succeed or fail before we pass judgment. She literally did nothing on this show to show us whether or not she'll be any good in the role. So it's up for debate whether or not she will actually do well. But again, let's give it some time and see what happens. Stephanie McMahon once had no experience and no business, quite frankly, being on TV, and she matured into being a pretty damn good television character. And you could say the same thing about Vicky Guerrero. It's awful in many ways as she still is. It's kind of part of her charm and part of her character, and she is light years better now than she was, you know, 3 or 4 years ago. So I'm willing to give it a chance. Backstage, Christopher Daniels and Kazarian were appalled that Dixie made no mention of AJ Styles during her speech, playing off the storyline of there being some sort of relationship between Styles and Dixie. They aired a flashback video touting 10 years of TNA, showing Christian Cage's debut in 2005, where he talked about being proud to be in a place that respects wrestling. And I half expect Christian now to get buried on TV, even though this video is 7 years old. I can totally see Vince being petty like that. Next up, they announced that, surprise, Jeff Hardy had won the fan voting to challenge D-Von for his television title. Jeff's new face paint with the paint on his eyelids really freaks me out, by the way. I just want to put that out there. He and D-Von had a short match that ended when Robbie E and Robbie T interfered. They cleared the ring of the heels. They celebrated together. Finishes like this really make fan voting seem totally irrelevant. So WWE should be mindful of that as well. If they're going to start incorporating more interactive elements into their shows and they want the fans to know that they have the ability to vote on matches and stipulations and stuff, if, you know, 75% of the time they're just going to end with some sort of DQ or interference or something where the match essentially means nothing, then people are going to figure, well, our vote really doesn't mean shit, so who cares? So you can't do finishes like this all the time. If it's a one-time thing, that's fine, but they need to be mindful of that, I think, going forward. Next, we have the gut check segment in the ring. Pritchard, Snow, and Taz were in the middle of the ring when they introduced Joey Ryan, who came out looking like an opening match act. He just looks completely ridiculous. Pritchard argued that after 12 years in the business, if he hasn't made it yet, he's never going to make it, so he voted no to giving him a contract. Al Snow said that he didn't like Ryan, but he has potential, so he voted yes. And of course, it came down to Taz. Before he could say anything, Joey Ryan cut a promo saying that he was money, and you don't just leave money on the table. I'd have voted yes just to see the guy get his ass handed to him, then I would fire him. Taz didn't take too kindly to the promo. He said that if that was the best he could do, he was crazy. He voted no. Ryan said Taz was just an announcer, and he also had a line here where he questioned Pritchard's place in the business if he's making decisions like this, that being saying no to a talent like himself. I don't know how much of this gut check stuff is worked out in advance, but the minute he disrespected Pritchard like that, I knew his fate was sealed. You just don't do that. So Taz tore him to shreds on the mic. This whole thing got very heated to the point where I figured he was shooting on him. And regardless, this all felt very real. I enjoyed it immensely. If USA won't bring back Tough Enough and give us 5 minutes of Steve Austin every week, humiliating people on the mic at the end of every show, I'm happy to at least see Taz do it to somebody on Gut Check. Not every week, mind you, because the goal here is to actually sign some people who deserve a shot and hopefully they get over. But some of these guys deserve to be embarrassed, and Taz is just the perfect person for that role. By the way, after the show, Joey Ryan actually took to Twitter and had this to say. He said, quote, "What a joke. Impact Wrestling is pathetic. I'm not good enough for your company. Come on, Dixie, really? You make me laugh. Don't bring me in just for your no agenda. It's not my fault that Ric Flair went into business for himself, so why am I being punished? Pritchard, Al Snow, and Taz know that a no is ridiculous. They know I'm money. I dare Taz to say something in my face now. Somebody tell Johnny Ace he can reach me at joeyryan@hotmail.com. I know he's not stupid enough to turn down money." Actually, WWE turns down easy money all the time. So if that's the guy's logic, he's going to be waiting by that phone an awfully long time. So Joey Ryan is obviously a little bent out of shape about what happened on Impact. Assuming this is all a shoot, of course. I'm assuming, perhaps foolishly, that this is not part of some storyline where Joey Ryan will come back and as some sort of heel character or something like that. If they want to maintain the integrity of Gut Check going forward, for their sake, I hope this was real and Joey Ryan is back on the indie scene. They aired a video of James Storm hanging out on his ranch with his young daughter riding horses. He talked about how he let everybody down by losing to Bobby Roode at Lockdown, in his own state, no less, of Tennessee. But he said he finally had made a decision about his future. And then his little girl asked if that meant Daddy was going to go back to wrestling, and he got all emotional and asked that the camera be turned off. I thought this was pretty well done. Main event, AJ Styles pinned Christopher Daniels in about 10 minutes. They had a good match, not as good as Punk vs. Bryan on Raw, or even Styles and Bobby Roode on Impact the week before, but still pretty good. After the match, Kazarian attacked Styles, and Kurt Angle ran down to make the save. He got attacked for his troubles, and they tried tying his arms to the ropes using these plastic ties. Apparently, they couldn't afford handcuffs in their budget. So this was the next best thing, only it really wasn't, because Kazarian could only tie one of Angle's wrists to the ropes. He was having a bitch of a time trying to tie the other one, so Daniels just grabbed his tag belt and clobbered Angle with it to knock him out. Quick thinking on his part. Daniels said they had photo evidence of AJ and Dixie together that they showed already. They had video evidence that they showed the world on their trusty iPad. And now he had possession of a phone conversation between the two lovebirds that he wanted to play. I think in most states that's probably against the law. I don't know what the rules are about this sort of thing in the state of Florida, so he should probably be mindful of that. So on the call, Styles asked when Dixie would be home tonight and if her husband Serge was going to be there, and Dixie sounded all excited to see AJ. At this point, an angry Dixie Carter came out by the announce desk. She demanded that they stop playing the audio. She threatened to fire whoever was responsible for playing the clip, and she said the word fuck, which was censored, of course, before the show suddenly ended. And perhaps Dixie would have better luck getting shit yanked off the air by just going directly to the production truck instead of harassing poor Mike Tenay. That was pretty stupid. But aside from that little lapse in logic, I actually thought it was a nice little cliffhanger for the show. Apparently, this is their big storyline right now, even bigger than the Joe Park stuff, and the ratings bear it out. There is an interest in this AJ Styles Dixie Carter storyline. I don't know where it's going or when it will culminate. I assume that in the end it will be revealed this is all not a misunderstanding, but the heels are not being entirely genuine about their motives here. It's not really a situation where AJ and Dixie are in some sort of, you know, having some sort of affair, unless they want to turn AJ Styles heel, which I don't think they want to. And quite frankly, much like Jeff Hardy, we've already seen AJ Styles as a heel, and it did not work. Because if AJ Styles as a heel worked, he'd still be a heel now. He is not a heel. He is a babyface. There's a reason for that. So I think that would be a mistake. Where this goes, we'll see. You know, like I said, this was not a perfect show by any means, but it was a good show. I see people immediately when the show is over on Facebook and Twitter, oh, this was 100% garbage. And I think it's a case where either people are not watching the show, because look, for the longest time, I can't tell you the last time I've been consistently able to watch Impact the full 2 hours week after week. I catch what I can. Usually I catch the key segments, much like SmackDown. This time I sat down to watch the entire show. It made sense. They didn't try to insult my intelligence. Like, so many times Raw will just infuriate me because clearly they just don't give a fuck about their audience. They think we're all stupid idiots. I didn't get that feeling by watching Impact. I didn't get the feeling I got when Vince Russo used to write and he tried to cram 16 million different things in a two-hour show. It was paced better. Things made sense. They had two or three key storylines that you can see progressing that are kind of interesting. They had a couple of good matches. If there's one other knock on the show, it's that there really wasn't any great matches. The main event got 10 minutes, but everything else was kind of like 3 minutes, 4 minutes. The matches were inconsequential. I just chalked that up to being the first live show. They wanted to fit a lot of stuff on the show and introduce some characters. The Brooke Hogan thing, which I could have done without. So I don't think, you know, for a first show, if you want to look at it like that, you know, they felt that they couldn't fit a 15 or 20 minute match on there, and that's fine. Bobby Roode and Sting opened the show. They had a pretty good match. I think that was good enough. But back to what I was saying before, I think it's a case where either people didn't actually watch the show and they just read the results, or they're just so conditioned to think that Impact is complete shit that to them it's going to be complete shit no matter what. And you have to realize something, that when I come on this show, if I bash a pay-per-view, if I bash Impact, if I bash Raw, I try to go out of my way to watch it before I bash it. And if I bash it, there's got to be a pretty goddamn good reason I'm bashing it. And for the people who have listened to this show for the longest time, I'd like to think you have a little bit of faith in my ability to decipher a good wrestling show from a bad wrestling show. Everybody can draw their own opinions, but I think people listen to the show because they trust that I know the difference from one to the other and they're interested in hearing my insights. So if you are interested in hearing my insights, then take this to heart. This was not a bad show. This was not a horrible show by any stretch of the imagination. I have seen so many goddamn awful Raw shows and Impact. The problem TNA has is they were awful for so long that even when they get good, people don't want to give them a chance. And I think that's what we see here. Now, maybe next week, Impact is complete shit. I'm going to tune in, I'm going to watch, and maybe they actually take two steps back. We'll see. It's not taped anymore, for the time being anyway. It's live, so we can't read the spoilers to know what happened. We'll find out next Thursday. I'm going to give them another chance, because they earned that, I think, with this show. Unfortunately, Mr. Nielsen was the bearer of bad news for TNA, as the ratings came in well below what they had been doing in their normal tape time slot. Impact scored an 0.89 rating, which was good for about 1.3 million viewers, down nearly 10% from previous weeks. To me, you don't panic yet about a number like that because it's a new time slot. Raw experiences the exact same thing anytime they have a three-hour show. People either forget about the earlier time, and I've done that myself, where it's 2 hours before the show, I'm leaving work, and I realize, shit, Raw's 3 hours tonight. No matter how many times they advertise it, they try to drill it into your head. If it's out of the norm, because wrestling fans are creatures of habit, you have a routine, you break the routine, people tend to forget. So it's either that, or people simply are not able to tune in an hour earlier. Whatever the case may be, I would say the number that really matters is the one that we see 3 or 4 weeks from now. This is going to be a summer-long experiment for TNA, unless they pull the plug earlier than that, for TNA and Spike. So give it 3 weeks, 4 weeks, and let's see where the Impact numbers stand then. If it continues to drop, or it hovers under a 1.0, that's going to be a cause for concern, and this little summer experiment may end fairly quickly. But you need to establish the new time first before you can actually make that call. I thought this was a good show. I'd hate for Spike or TNA to make changes after only one or two shows and go into full-on panic mode. I think that would be a mistake. Let's move on to Raw, which emanated from New Orleans, Louisiana this week. Raw Monday Night was the Big Show Revenge Show. It's another title for it. It was okay. It wasn't a bad show or anything, but I thought it was a bit on the boring side, quite frankly. John Cena wasn't there, which is nice for a change. We did get a CM Punk versus Daniel Bryan match out of it, which I can't complain about. We also saw the seeds finally planted for Dolph Ziggler to break out on his own again, which I've been advocating for a while now. This was the annual Memorial Day edition of Raw, so of course the show opened with a very classy tribute to those that have served this country and lost their lives. WWE always does a tremendous job with these videos. Big Show came out to start with a promo. after telling us last week that he did not owe us, the fans, an explanation for his actions at Over the Limit. He must have had a change of heart, because we got a 15-minute explanation of exactly why he helped John Laurinaitis. He said it was a business decision. He has to make a living. He has an ironclad contract now with a big fat bonus and is set for life. I don't know about you, but I think it's bad policy on WWE's part to be giving out so many ironclad contracts. This is going to come back to bite them on the ass at some point. Kind of like those guaranteed contracts that WCW used to hand out like candy. Big Show said he was hurt by the fact that as he groveled for his job and Johnny Ace fired him on TV, nobody from the dressing room came to his defense. He showed footage of Brodus Clay, Kofi Kingston, and R-Truth dancing in the segment immediately after his firing, which at the time I thought was a really stupid thing for them to do. And I would like to think that it was all planned out that way and give them some credit for it, but I don't think it really was planned out that way. I find it impossible to believe that this company could have thought this storyline out that far in advance. The way they've been booking of late, I refuse to believe that. But Big Show did make a good point here. At least this made sense in that respect. He thought John Cena was also a friend of his, but when Cena came out later that night, all he did was tell jokes. Well, that's what Cena does. It's all he knows. Does a fish not need water? Does a dog not need a fire hydrant to pee on? I mean, come on. So anyway, Big Show is absolutely right, and I could empathize with him when this whole segment was over. So I don't see him as much of a heel now as I do a crusader for justice. That's how I look at Big Show. He's like a superhero. He also said John Laurinaitis would give him the ability to choose his opponent for later tonight, so that would come into play a little bit later. Alberto Del Rio beat Santino Marella, the United States champion, mind you, in about 30 seconds. This was worse than a Divas match. I should have busted out the old stopwatch for this. Next week, you know what, next week I say they should bring back Medusa and have her drop the U.S. title in a trash can and set it on fire, because quite frankly, that's where this thing belongs. Backstage, Big Show threw Alex Riley into a wall. Didn't CM Punk tell Riley in a backstage segment a couple weeks ago that he owed him $50, but he didn't say for what? Maybe this was Punk's way of sending a message to the locker room by hiring Big Show to be his heavy. That'd actually be a better storyline. And I just came up with it in 3 seconds. Kofi Kingston and R-Truth retained their tag titles over Jack Swagger and Dolph Ziggler. Swagger took the fall in this one. After the match, Ziggler shouted that he was better than this, and he walked off. Preach on, my brother. Backstage, Big Show threatened Santino, suggested that perhaps he would pick him to be his opponent later in the night. When Brodus Clay walked up, got all up in Big Show's grill, Clay told Big Show to pick him, and actually acted like a bit of a badass here, standing up to the Giant. Show agreed and said that Clay would not be able to dance anymore when he was through with him. This is how Brodus needs to be booked more often. Show a bit of a mean streak and not just be a dancing fool all the time. They told us that Brodus is 22-0 so far since coming back to TV, and he's going into this match undefeated. So he's like Goldberg, only with rhythm. John Laurinaitis came out next to announce that John Cena vs. Big Show at No Way Out will be a steel cage match. He also revealed the cover for the WWE 13 video game, which is due out in October, and which will apparently have some sort of attitude era mode, which means that I am only going to get more questions from people about PG, so thanks a lot, WWE. Laurinaitis himself is on the cover. CM Punk came out, had them roll out this huge banner from the ceiling like they used to do when they would reveal those Playboy covers with Chyna and Sable. Only this time it was an image of the actual cover for WWE 13, which features CM Punk with his head cut off. I'm not really sure what the point of doing this now was, being that the game isn't coming out for another 5 months. Laurinaitis then wished Punk good luck in his match against Daniel Bryan, and Punk told him that luck is for losers. CM Punk and Daniel Bryan had a non-title match on free TV, and it was really, really good. Not as good as their pay-per-view match, but it shouldn't be as good as what you would see on pay-per-view. And even a very good Punk vs. Bryan match is still light years ahead of most matches you'll see on WWE TV. AJ came down to the ring later on. She played into the finish. She was arguing with the referee as Bryan removed one of the turnbuckle pads. Punk ended up getting dropped on the exposed steel, and Bryan pinned him. At that exact moment, I was filled with glee as I realized that Bryan would, in fact, get his rematch for the championship. My glee then turned to horror as Kane came out and attacked Daniel Bryan. He chokeslammed him onto a chair. AJ gave Punk a chair, and he went after Kane with it. And my worst fears were confirmed on SmackDown this week when John Laurinaitis announced that there would be a triple threat match at No Way Out for the title, pitting Punk against both Daniel Bryan and Kane. Why is this a better match than having Punk versus Bryan in a cage? Can somebody answer that for me? Daniel Bryan had an awesome cage match late last year on SmackDown with Mark Henry, of all people. So much so that I was actually okay with the idea that maybe they would do Bryan and Henry at WrestleMania for the World Heavyweight title. That was before Henry got hurt and Bryan turned heel. But that was an awesome cage match. Imagine what he and Punk could do in there. Well, keep imagining, because we're not going to find out. Christian pinned The Miz with the kill switch and a frog splash. You know, normally as a wrestler gets older, he does fewer moves from the top rope. Christian has now decided to use the kill switch as a setup move so he can climb to the top for his new finisher. Seems a bit odd to me, but I guess he wanted to change things up a bit. After the match, Miz got on the mic and started complaining about something. I really wasn't paying attention, so I don't know what he was saying. Randy Orton came out to shut him up with an RKO. Perhaps out of anger that Miz took his role in the Marine 3. And by the way, how good does that decision look now by WWE, taking Orton off that movie and replacing him with somebody else? It would look pretty bad to have him filming a movie after getting suspended. They actually lucked out on that one. Although I still wouldn't have gone with Miz in this movie, but that's just me. By the way, while Orton was posing, we got a shot of Dolph Ziggler and Vicky Guerrero backstage looking on, teasing a Ziggler versus Orton match at the pay-per-view that will now not be happening. Where that leaves poor Dolph is anyone's guess. I guess a match with Swagger. Great. I fully expect it to be the pre-show match if that happens. I'm calling it now. Sheamus beat David Otunga with a brogue kick. Nothing much to it. Otunga is kind of like this generation's version of Jim Powers or Paul Roma, only with more charisma and a bow tie. You know, like them, he's got a great physique, and for that reason, you'd expect that WWE would shoot this guy to the moon, but he really is just a jobber to the stars. That's really all he is. Big Show and Brodus Clay never had their match in the main event, as Big Show speared him outside the ring and just beat the crap out of the poor guy. He threw him into the post. He struck him across the back a couple of times with the lid from the announce table. Kofi and Truth ran out to try to save the Funkasaurus. They got laid out for their troubles. Show clocked Brodus with the knockout punch and left him laying to end the show. This was a fine destruction, exactly how you would book a giant like Big Show, but how many times have we seen this over the past 14 years? It's the same thing with Kane. You know, it won't be long before he's back to smiling and joking and being a comedy figure. They've gone back and forth on these guys so many times, it gives me a headache just thinking about it. Plus, these guys have turned so many times. It's hard for anybody, I think, to really care when you turn babyface and heel, literally 25 times. But on this show, Big Show looked real strong. WWE did a good job with him. I actually can't be too hard on them because, as I'm sure you've already read on SE Scoops, WWE recognizes that the Lord Tensai character was an utter failure. The plan was for Tensai to be Laurinaitis' henchman and feud with John Cena and do house show handicap matches with Tensai and Johnny against Cena, but the dude just did not get over at all. So Big Show was basically plan B for this feud, which is funny because if you'll recall, when I did my Brock Lesnar book review on the Sound Off several weeks ago, for Lesnar's book Death Clutch, I talked about the Survivor Series in 2002 and how Big Show was a plan B back then as well. It was supposed to be Lesnar against Hulk Hogan at the pay-per-view that year, but plans fell through. Big Show was moved into a feud with Brock instead. He was plan B. Well, here we are 10 years later, and yet again, Big Show is the backup. And in this case, I give WWE credit for doing the right thing in that Vince can be a very stubborn person. He could have easily tried to shove Tensai down our throats and feuded him with Cena anyway. And how fucking awful would that have been? At least here, he had enough sense to recognize that it was a failure, the fans weren't reacting, and he made a change. He deviated from the plan. For once, I'm actually happy he did. By the way, for as bad as Mr. Nielsen was to TNA this week in the ratings department, he is an equal opportunity offender, and also delivered some bad news to WWE. Raw pulled a 2.7 rating this week, good for about 3.9 million viewers, far below even the low numbers that they had been doing of late. Much like with TNA, I would hope that panic does not set in here and they give it a week to see if the number rebounds, because it was, after all, Memorial Day. It is true the past couple of years of Memorial Day shows have not done as badly as this one did, but it's still a holiday, and so therefore you have to throw it out, as far as I'm concerned. The one really bad thing is that CM Punk versus Daniel Bryan, which was the main event for the 10 p.m. hour, at the top of the hour, rather, that match lost a ton of viewers. I think it was something like over 400,000 people tuned out for that match, which does not bode well for those guys, which is a damn shame. Punk's numbers as champion have just been horrendous. And it's a miracle, quite frankly, that WWE has kept the title on him as long as they have, given how fickle they can be about these quarter-hour numbers and all that kind of stuff. So I'm glad they have. I'm glad that they've stuck to their guns. I think CM Punk has given a lot of stability to the championship. He's already got one of the longest reigns, aside from John Cena, in the last several years. I don't know if he's going to drop it at No Way Out. I mean, to me, Punk is still very over. For whatever reason, it doesn't translate to ratings on TV, but he's very over. He's, you know, the number two or three guy in the company right now, which is funny I say that, being that he's the champion, but he really is not number one. John Cena is. But you've kept the title on him now for 6-7 months. I feel it would be a mistake to take it off him at anything other than a big pay-per-view. You know, I mean, I guess they could do it at Money in the Bank. It's kind of like he's come full circle. It was Money in the Bank last year when he beat Cena for the championship. It's too bad he lost the title in between there and hasn't held it since then. But to me, Punk at this point ought to hold on to that title until SummerSlam or even Survivor Series. Let him go a year. Let him go a year with the championship. But I said it last week, if John Cena is going to continue to be featured in every single main event and CM Punk is going to be relegated to the undercard, if that's what they're going to do, then even though I'd love to see Punk hold on to the title another couple of months, you have to put the title on Cena. Otherwise, let Punk be in the main event. He is, after all, your world champion, and let him hold it for a year. Let him have a year-long title reign. We haven't seen one of those in a long time. It'll mean that much more when he does drop the championship, whether it's to Daniel Bryan, if he drops it to Brock Lesnar, you know, or if he does drop it to John Cena. You could do a babyface versus babyface match. I don't know where they're going with it, but you know, it's for whatever reason, it just doesn't translate over to television. People just tune out during CM Punk's matches. I mean, he had a match once on Raw with 2 months ago, whatever it was, with The Miz. Now, granted, it was The Miz, but he had a match with The Miz that literally drove off like over 800,000 people. I mean, those are numbers. Even the Divas don't drive that many people away. And I don't know exactly why that is. I don't have a good answer for you. I mean, Punk has gotten himself over. He is a genuine main eventer now. He is a genuine star, but for whatever reason, people just don't necessarily look at him like that, and they don't think that his segments are worth sticking around for. It's kind of a weird situation. WWE is advertising, by the way, the return of Triple H and Shawn Michaels as DX for the 1,000th Raw show in St. Louis on July 23rd. I'm sure more big names will be announced in the weeks to come, including maybe Mick Foley. As I've said before, that might be the perfect time to debut Dean Ambrose and do something with him and Foley, being that it gives Foley an excuse for being there instead of him just randomly, you know, showing up for Raw 1 week. So we'll see what happens there. That's coming up in July. That again will be the first 3-hour Raw show that kicks off the new era of permanent 3-hour shows. So enjoy your 2-hour Raws while they last. Let's get into some sound off shout outs here. You can email me your shout outs and questions, of course, at thesolomonster@gmail.com. thesolomonster@gmail.com. This one comes from Sean Garcia. He says, I just graduated from the 8th grade and was wondering if I could get a shout out. I listen to you every Sunday night just before I go to bed. Well, congrats, Sean. Kick ass in high school. That's really cool. James writes in, Solomonster, you should give yourself a shout out for having the best podcast. Also, what do you think of the TNA Hall of Fame? I don't know. Who's in it? No, I think it's a nice idea. They, you know, TNA's been around now for 10 years, which in and of itself is a victory, given so many years they were in the red, bleeding money. The fact that they're still around and they have the kind of support that they do from a major cable network like Spike TV is good for them. And as WWE has shown, Hall of Fame stuff can be very profitable. It's a profitable gimmick, which is what it is. And that might upset certain people, but let's call a spade here. WWE themselves even admits the Hall of Fame is a gimmick. They do it because they can make money off of it. How many years went by after they created their Hall of Fame in 93? How many years went by between, I think, 97 and 2003 where they had no new Hall of Fame inductions? Not even a mention of it. And they brought it back in 04 because they figured they can sell it on DVD and make some money off it. And then it did well. People got excited about it. People started taking it way more seriously, I think, than even the company itself was taking it at the time. And the next year they put in Hogan and the people from WrestleMania 1 and Bret Hart was in 06, and it became a very big deal. And they started putting the Hall of Fame, which was once held in little banquet halls at hotels and wasn't even necessarily open to the general public, all of a sudden Hall of Fame ceremonies are now in large 15,000-seat arenas. They make a killing off the ticket sales and the DVD sales, and it's a gimmick. So you know what? If it works for WWE and it makes them some coin, then why not try it if you're TNA? I don't know if that TNA is going to make a lot of money off it. Apparently, there's not going to be any sort of ceremony. They're just going to announce the name of the first inductee. There won't be a physical Hall of Fame unless they build something at Universal Studios, which, you know what, I guess they could actually do something like that. TNA will, you know, could very well have a physical Hall of Fame before WWE does. It'd be interesting to see if they actually go in that direction. So, to answer your question, I think it's a fine idea. I say why not? And like I said, AJ Styles, to me, probably makes the most sense as an initial inductee, if not Jeff Jarrett or... hell, Don West is leaving. Don West has been with the company since day one, and like I said, he has played an instrumental role in the success of that company. I would actually be totally fine if they wanted to honor Don West on his way out by inducting him into the Hall of Fame. I don't know that Don West as the first ever inductee is necessarily what they want to do. You know, even in the WWE Hall of Fame, they essentially created it to put Andre the Giant in there as the first inductee, and so having Andre as the first WWE Hall of Fame inductee and having Don West as the first TNA Hall of Fame inductee, I could see where maybe people wouldn't want to do that. But we'll find out on June 10th, not September 10th, as Dixie said on TV. By the way, you'll all be happy to know that yours truly finally has DVR at home. I have finally entered the 21st century. I did it so I would no longer have to deal with questions about why I don't have it. And the timing is perfect, actually, because I won't be home to watch Impact Live this week, so I will be recording it. Impact Wrestling on Thursday will be my first official recording on the new DVR, so I'll let you know how that goes. But I thought I should mention that here, because I still get questions every now and then from people who slip in a little mention about it. They say, oh, I can't believe you don't have DVR. And I think one person was actually kind enough to offer me an old TiVo that he had to send it over to me, which I appreciate. But I now have finally entered the modern age, so you can all rest easy now and don't ask me any more questions about it. Do some mailbag questions. Again, you can email me your questions at thesolemnmonster@gmail.com. This question here comes from Stuart. Wanted my thoughts on a potential feud. As far as I'm aware, Ryback and Brodus Clay are still undefeated. So what if WWE continued this, having them squash guys until SummerSlam and then put them in a match? It would be a good way to put them both over as two new faces in a big-time match. Have Ryback win and continue to be undefeated. But for the next couple of months, have him in high-profile matches, matches that actually mean something. So have him go over guys like Orton, Big Show, Sheamus, and even John Cena. Then he can go into the Rumble undefeated, win it, and challenge The Undertaker. I think it would be different having this young guy dominate people, destroying everyone, and then going up against the dead man. I also think it could work if during their feud, WWE would leak stories that Vince sees a bright future in Ryback, making people actually think this new guy can end the streak. What do you think? I don't think it's a bad idea. I really don't think it's a bad idea. Now, apparently, The Undertaker, a little bit of a spoiler here, I guess, but The Undertaker's feud, The Undertaker's match at WrestleMania next year that WWE is now looking at is Undertaker and Brock Lesnar. So already they're changing their minds on a potential Rock match for the championship next year. They're now looking at Lesnar and The Undertaker. And the fact is that if that's what they're going to do, and they'll probably change their minds again, but if that's what they're going to do, you got to do Lesnar against Undertaker, because Lesnar versus Undertaker is one of the biggest matches that you could do with Undertaker that could really make them some money. I don't know what the actual main event will be. I don't know what the championship match will be. I presume Rock will be involved in some way, but I don't know. Especially now with his movie, his G.I. Joe movie, the release of the movie being pushed back to WrestleMania time next year. I don't even know how that might impact their plans for him at the pay-per-view. But Brock Lesnar and The Undertaker is a big-time, potentially big-money match. You go with the match that has the ability to make you the most money. And so, if given the choice, obviously you go with Lesnar and The Undertaker. If you're trying to get a new guy over, this, I think, is as good of an idea as any. And you mentioned something very important about Ryback that I wanted to mention here. We've seen Ryback on television now squashing people for a couple of months. I'm an old-school fan in that I remember the days of watching squash matches every week on the syndicated shows, okay, on Superstars and Wrestling Challenge and Primetime Wrestling and stuff like that. Even the earlier days of Monday Night Raw, those first couple of years, the first 3 or 4 years, excuse me, they still had squash matches. And they serve a very valuable purpose in that even if you just knew this was a waste of time, I know who's going to win, what's the point of this? The point was it was an opportunity to showcase guys, to let them do some moves, to get their moves over, to get themselves over, to get them some TV time. Instead of taking, like today, what they would do, or for the last couple of years, what they would do is if a new guy debuted, his first match was against an established guy. You know, and there would be times when he couldn't even get a clean win in his first match because they didn't want to take the existing guy that they had, the mid-card guy, and make him lose and look like a jobber. Well, that's the whole purpose of jobbers. That's why they're there. That's why they were traditionally used. So I like the fact that we're seeing more, quote, jobber matches, I guess you would say, in WWE. But here's the problem. Ryback has been beating up nobodies now for a couple of months. At some point, Ryback has to face somebody of note. He's already past that point. He should already be facing people that have an established name on the SmackDown brand. I'm not saying he should have a match with John Cena or Randy Orton yet, but Ryback coming out every week and beating up, you know, Joe Blow number one and Joe Schmo number two doesn't do Ryback any good. You know, the first couple of weeks, fine. What purpose now is it serving Ryback to come out and beat the shit out of guys that nobody knows? So they've got to get him in a feud with somebody. And Brodus Clay, you know what? Brodus Clay is the same thing. Brodus, before they did that stuff with him and Big Show on Monday night, what the hell was Brodus Clay doing? He had a couple of matches with The Miz, and that was it. Brodus needs to do more as well. Now, they're both babyfaces. At least, I presume Ryback is a babyface. I guess they really haven't done anything specific to tell us that. For all I know, Ryback is a heel. But he's certainly been portrayed as a guy that they want the fans to start getting behind him in a Goldberg type of way. He's a guy who goes out there, he smashes people, they're hoping that people will get behind him, and I don't know that it's really happening in droves or anything. I don't hear the crowds going crazy for him. He's, I guess, a little more over than Lord Tensai, so that's a victory for him. But, you know, Brodus and Ryback, with Ryback going over, I'd be okay with that. And then, as you said, the key is having Ryback in matches against established guys. Now, you mentioned Orton, Big Show, Sheamus, and Cena. Wishful thinking, my friend. First of all, you know, he's going from the outhouse to the penthouse. You know, you're skipping over so many guys in between. You can't just throw them in feuds with people that are in the main event. Because there's no way that Ryback is going to get clean wins over all those guys. And he can ill afford to lose, being that you're trying to do an undefeated streak with the guy. So I don't like the idea of putting him in there, let's say, with John Cena, because we all know how that ends. But the idea of building him up, giving him actual competition so he can start showing us something, and building him for a match with Undertaker if they were going to go in a different direction than Undertaker and Brock, I would actually be okay with that. And you mentioned the Rumble. Him winning the Rumble and challenging the Undertaker. That was an idea that I talked about for this year. To change things up a little bit with the Royal Rumble, being that titles don't mean shit anyway. The streak has been built up as one of the few things that matters at WrestleMania. It's a big deal. It would have been unique to have the, not the streak on the line, but instead of having a title up for grabs in the Rumble, to have the winner challenge the Undertaker. Because Undertaker is now going to be in a high-profile match every year he continues to wrestle. Sometimes, if some people might argue, it's even the real main event. So why not do something like that with the Rumble? They didn't do it this year. Maybe they could do it next year. But I think your general idea is dead on. And the key there is get Ryback some real opponents instead of these idiots that nobody gives a shit about. Because You keep doing it week after week. I don't see what the point of it is anymore. What is the point of Ryback going out there and just beating these nobodies? You already did that. Put him in there with somebody that actually has a name. Put him in there with, you know, Drew McIntyre, and then work your way up to bigger names from there. Alexander writes in, Dear Solomonster, why do guys like Test and Billy Gunn never become solo main eventers? And do you think CM Punk and Daniel Bryan open WWE's eyes for wrestlers like Antonio Cesaro and Dean Ambrose, who also travel the world gaining experience? Well, to answer your first question first, Test, I had heard, first of all, forget what I heard. What I saw was that Test had a lot of potential to be a main event guy. Test was over like gangbusters during that storyline with Stephanie and Shane in the summer of 1999, and their match, that Love Her or Leave Her match between Test and Shane at SummerSlam 99, was awesome. I mean, that match blew me away. It was so much better than I had expected it to be going in, and it's a credit to both Test and Shane McMahon and the Mean Street Posse, who were fucking awesome at the time. That whole story was great, and Test won the match. The people went nuts. He embraced Stephanie. Of course, they were going to get married. We all know what happened with Triple H, and the rest is history. But they didn't really do anything with Test after that. Test's push kind of stalled at that point. And I had heard, you know, years later, there were, of course, politics behind it. I'm not going to say it was Triple H, but there were people behind the scenes who did not want to see Test succeed. And it's the same thing we've seen time and time again with WWE, where they'll build somebody up, they'll push them, and then they'll pull the rug out from underneath them. They'll break them down because they want them to, quote, pay their dues. And they try to build them back up. And more often than not, shockingly enough, those guys can't get over again at the level they were once at, because they have already been conditioned by the company to think that these guys are losers. They had their chance. They blew it. Why should I get behind them now? Test had something in 99. Test could have been a world champion one day had they continued pushing him that way in 99. And, you know, at the same time, maybe he would have gotten even better in the ring. He wasn't bad at the time, but he had something. And that's WWE's fault for dropping the ball. They really fucked up on that one, in my opinion. Billy Gunn, they gave every opportunity in the world to. He just couldn't get over. I mean, that's just the bottom line. Billy Gunn's a great athlete. He's a great bump taker. He's great in the role that he portrayed when he was with the Outlaws and all that. He was very good. But main event guy, he just didn't have it. They gave him the King of the Ring tournament in 99. They gave him a SummerSlam match with The Rock. They had big ideas and high hopes for the guy, but he just wasn't getting over at the level they had hoped that he would. And, you know, promo-wise, he really just wasn't that good either. He was okay. That's really the story there. Test had something. He was getting over. They fucked up. Billy Gunn, look at Chris Masters years later. And I don't want to compare the two directly just because I think Billy Gunn was better than Chris Masters. But, you know, they had a guy who had a good look, who they wanted to move up to another level. The fans had other ideas. They said, no, we reject that idea. We like him where he is now. And it just didn't work out. As far as Punk and Bryan opening up eyes in the company and paving the way, maybe an easier road for people like Cesaro and Ambrose and Cassius Ohno to go down, I think they have. In fact, in the case of Punk, I know they have, because the word on the street, so to speak, was after Punk worked with Triple H last year at the whatever the hell that pay-per-view was in September, the Unforgiven, I guess. It used to be Unforgiven. I don't know what the hell it is now. But after they worked together, Triple H, you know, told people backstage that, you know, this kid's got it, whatever, he's the real deal. You know, as if he was like the last person in the world to realize this. We already knew that Punk was a good worker. He didn't have to prove himself to anybody at that point. But he opened up a lot of eyes back then, and then Daniel Bryan got over when they did not expect him to. Daniel Bryan is the kind of guy, you just look at him, and he just doesn't look like the kind of guy WWE would push as a headliner. And believe me, they were not going to. But he got over, and they realized, and plus, he can have a good match with almost anybody. You know, I'm sure they evaluated his work on the road and at the TVs and how many great matches he was having, and they realized this guy's the real deal. So, you know, they didn't get any favors from anybody. They don't play politics behind the scenes. They got over on their own talents, which is a really cool thing to see. And I think, I think they're more open now to people from the, quote, you know, the indie guys, the indie scene guys from Ring of Honor and Dragon Gate and Evolve and places like that. And plus, they're recruiting cruiserweight talent for that new show, for the new network. So you're going to see more guys like that, I think, come to developmental. They have other guys in developmental right now as well that they plucked off the independent scene. I don't think you would have seen that 5 years ago in WWE. In fact, I know you wouldn't have, because at one point, Vince McMahon had a decree that I assume is no longer in place that they weren't even looking at guys that were under 6'2", 240 pounds. They actually had a set criteria for height and weight, and if anybody was under that, they were too short, they were too small, we're not interested. Think about all the talented guys on the indie scene who busted their ass for years to get a shot in WWE, and at one time, the rule in developmental was we won't even consider those guys. And it's been said before that if guys like Shawn Michaels and Bret Hart were coming up in today's WWE, in today's wrestling world, a couple years ago when this was being enforced, think of all the talented guys who went on to become Hall of Famers that they wouldn't have even given them a second look. It's a mentality that is so damaging to wrestling. And guys like Punk and Bryan have gotten over on their own and have proven that, you know what, maybe these guys, we should give them a look. So I think they've done a lot of good for the guys in developmental and really guys all over the independent scene. I think you're going to see more of them signing contracts with FCW, or if FCW goes away, whatever their new developmental system is going to be. This question comes from Matthew. After reading reports of Tensai disappointing WWE officials, I was thinking of a gimmick that could work for him when it suddenly occurred to me they should bring back the old hip-hop hippo. Maybe have him feud with the Funkasaurus as a comedy angle. What are your thoughts on this? Also, do you have any suggestions as to what WWE should do with him? Yeah, not that. You mentioned Brodus. I think one comedy character, we have a bunch. You got Brodus, you've got Santino. How many comedy characters do you really need? Matt Bloom is a good athlete. I think he's been tremendously disappointing in this role since he's come back to WWE. I heard so many things about how much better he was in Japan. I watched some of his matches on YouTube, and he came across as being great in that role, I guess, in that he was the dominant monster foreigner in Japan, in New Japan, where he wrestled, and was good in that role. And for whatever reason, it just hasn't translated here in WWE. I think part of it might be the character. You know, the character is booked in a way where he moves kind of slowly in the ring. He looks slow and plodding. I mean, last week, they did the handicap match in the main event with Cena and Sheamus against Ziggler, Swagger, and Tensai. And there was this one part where Tensai went to give Punk, he went to pick him up for a body slam. This is CM Punk, who his legitimate weight cannot be much more than 200 pounds, if that. It just can't be. 200-pound guy, and he struggled to pick him up for a body slam. Now, I don't know what the hell is up with that, but we've seen things like that. I mean, his matches, they're just boring. So I can see your point in that you want to introduce some fun and make him entertaining in some way, and if his matches are going to bore people, at least if he's the hip-hop hippo, it'll be fun. But we don't need more comedy characters. I think, you know, the best thing for him, and quite frankly, I'll call it right now, I don't know what their new plans are going to be for Tensai. He's still Tensai. He's not Lord Tensai now. He's just Tensai. He doesn't come out with the garb and the gear anymore and the headgear and all that, and apparently at the at some of the dark matches and stuff, he's actually bullying his manager, Sakamoto. I haven't seen him do it on TV yet, but they seem headed for a breakup already. I think within a few months, we're going to see A-Train or Albert. He's just going to revert back to his old gimmick and just be a normal guy who goes in there and kicks ass. And quite frankly, that might just be the best role for him. I don't want to see him in there cracking jokes and dancing with children and stuff like that, but obviously, this gimmick isn't working, so just let him be himself. Let him be the A-Train. Or Albert. I mean, you know, A-Train I thought was a better gimmick in that the Albert name was kind of an albatross for him for so long. But the fans haven't been chanting A-Train as much as they've been chanting Albert. So if the fans want Albert, I say give them Albert. Give the fans what they want. Call him Albert. Let him go in there. Give him some of that old gear, by the way, he used to wear, because he's looking a little pudgy in the waistline there. So give him the black sleeveless singlet, the shirt, whatever it was that he used to wear. Black is a very slimming color. It works for Kane. It'll work for Albert. And just give the people what they want. Let him go in there and kick ass. He's a big dude. He's 6'8", probably legitimately 275, 280, if I had to take a guess. He's not 350 as they bill him on TV. That's the biggest load of shit I've ever heard. He ain't 350 pounds, I guarantee you that. But that's what I would do with him. It's very simple. See, the key here is don't overthink it. What would you do with this guy? God, you know, I got to sit here all day and think about these ideas. You don't have to think so hard your brain hurts. Sometimes these things are really easy. Just let the guy be himself. It's very simple. Jonathan from the UK writes in, how far do you think the Mr. McMahon character reflected the real Vince McMahon? How much was acting and how much was real? I would just say this. I would say that I think the Mr. McMahon character was closer to the Vince McMahon in real life than anybody would like to admit. I know Vince McMahon has a soft side and a family side, and you know, they do charity work and all that kind of stuff. I'm not saying he's legitimately pure evil, as the Mr. McMahon character was often portrayed on TV, but you know, you see things like that HBO interview with Armin Katan from many years ago when he slapped the papers out of his hand, the stuff with Bob Costas. You can argue he was being in character during those interviews. I don't think he was. I think if you look at the evolution of Vince McMahon, the person, over the years, interviews that he's done, go back and watch some of those segments from the mid-80s that they did even, and they interviewed Vince. They had like 20 segments from 2020. I mean, you can find this stuff on YouTube. Vince always had this this attitude, this air about him, easily irritable, I think, in a lot of ways, and also just a sick bastard, quite frankly. Some of the ideas and concepts for gimmicks that he's had, the toilet humor that he likes, and all that kind of stuff. I told the story, the bowling story. I think I mentioned that here on the show from Frank DeFord and you know, the dick jokes at the bowling party. I think I mentioned this on the air. I mean, there's a whole history here of the kind of person that Vince McMahon is in real life. And I wouldn't call him pure evil. I'm sure there's a nice side and a very charitable side to him. But I think the Mr. McMahon character was an extension of the real Vince McMahon. With the volume turned up, as you know, you've heard Main Eventer say that before. Steve Austin at his peak would comment that, you know, this is the real me, only with the volume turned up 100%. And I think the same could be said for Vince as well. I don't think Vince literally barges around his office, you know, telling women to get down on all fours and bark like a dog. At least I hope not. But I do think that the Mr. McMahon character reflects the real Vince McMahon in a lot of ways that people don't realize. And that's coming from somebody who's... I've met Vince McMahon once, okay? I admit that. I don't know him personally. I'm willing to bet most people listening to the show don't know him personally. But, you know, you watch him on TV, you listen to him in interviews, and the congressional testimony, and just everything, all that kind of stuff. And you can draw... And what people that have worked for him have said, and you take that collectively, and you determine that this guy is a few French fries short of a Happy Meal. And he's a very eccentric kind of guy, and I think that that character is a good reflection of that. Valentino from Scotland writes in with two questions. First, was the actual wrestling in the Attitude Era better than it is today? I was too young to watch week-to-week programming back then, but I have seen some pay-per-view matches, which were normally high above average, but I find it hard to imagine that guys put on better matches than people like Ziggler, Punk, Brian, Kofi, and Rey Mysterio. That's one of the things I think people overlook very often about the Attitude Era, is that the matches that you would see from week to week on Raw, and even a lot of the pay-per-views, compared to the matches now, if you're judging it on work rate, sucked. There were a lot of terrible, god-awful matches back then. The 1999, you know, Royal Rumble show. I always look at that show as kind of a great reflection of this, because forget the Rock Mankind I Quit match. There were so many guys in that Rumble that I go back and watch that Rumble match now, and I look at it and I go, God, this sucked. You know, all these stupid gimmicks and these mid-card guys that, looking back on it now, I don't care about. But back then, it was all about your character. It was all about your gimmick. The one good thing was, you know, Russo and Vince and everybody who was writing and working backstage on creative at the time, you know, these guys wanted to make sure that the mid-card guys like a D'Lo Brown and a Val Venus and a Godfather, they all had a role on the show. They all had a character. That was a good way to get those guys over. But do you think the Godfather went in there and had great matches with Val Venus, or that they could have a better match than CM Punk and Daniel Bryan? Of course not. Of course not. So the actual matches and work rate, by and large, was nothing. I shouldn't say nothing, but it was really, compared to the way it is now, there really is no contest there. I think the matches in the ring that you get now are far better. But it's hard to compare, because you take a good pay-per-view main event back then between Steve Austin and The Rock or Steve Austin and Dude Love, one of my all-time favorite WWF matches, particularly back from the Attitude Era. May of 1998, Over the Edge. Vince McMahon is the guest referee, and Austin vs. Dude Love, which there is a university here in the States, I don't remember which one. At one time, they were offering a course in pro wrestling. They were teaching about pro wrestling, and the professor used that match to show his class as kind of a prime example of what wrestling used to be like when it was all crazy and wacky during the Attitude Era. That match had everything. It had good work. It had a good storyline. It had a great crowd. It had great drama because they were trying everything to screw Steve Austin out of the title. They stacked the deck. They had Vince as the ref, and Patterson, I think, was the timekeeper, and Gerald Briscoe was the ring announcer, or maybe Briscoe was the timekeeper, and Patterson was the ring announcer, and the drama was great. Austin was over like nobody else before, and they had a tremendous match. Now, compare it to CM Punk and Daniel Bryan. No, it's not the same kind of match, but that match was so much fun, so much goddamn fun to watch that match. And that was the case with a lot of those matches back then. The crowd was so much more into it. They were so amped up that even if you had what on most shows would be considered an average match, they could take an average match and make it match of the year. So it's hard to compare that era to this era. It was more character-driven, but there were also way more people into the product back then. I mean, a lot more. Go back and watch most of those Raw shows. You'll see a sea of signs. Compared to now, I don't want to say you don't see any signs, but you don't see nearly as many. And part of the problem also is that they confiscate a lot of signs now, more so than they did back then, because back then you can have people bringing sexually suggestive signs to Raw, and it was encouraged. It was part of, you know, DX telling everybody to suck it every week, and Mark Henry, you know, fondling a transvestite and whatever other bullshit was going on back then, and now it's obviously a more PG product. The second question that Valentino has, which is also a very good question, is, do you think it matters how good a wrestler someone is as long as they put in good matches? Take John Cena and Jack Swagger. Cena is not the best technical wrestler in the world, but puts on great matches, whereas Swagger is technically sound, but puts on shitty, boring matches. What do you think? I don't want to say that Jack Swagger puts on shitty, boring matches. I think that's kind of offensive to him. The reason that maybe his matches come off as shitty and boring is because of the way he's been booked. He has been booked to be a jobber. He has been booked to be a guy that nobody could possibly care about because all he ever does is lose. When his music hits, you groan. Just like I used to groan when the Big Boss Man would come out or X-Pac would come out in the late 90s. There's a reason it's called X-Pac Heat. It's like, you know, the music would hit and it's like, oh, God. And it's awful that I have that reaction whenever Jack Swagger comes out because he's a good wrestler. But it's the way he's been booked. Now, your point, I think, is a really good one. John Cena gets a lot of shit from people because he doesn't know all the wrestling holds and, you know, look, I made a comment after Extreme Rules. I said it on this show. I took the time to say that John Cena doesn't get enough credit for the good matches that he's in. If you look back at the last several years, John Cena has had a lot of great matches, and some of that has to do with his opponent and the people he's been in the ring with, but he had a great match one year at the Rumble, an I Quit match, I think it was, or a Last Man Standing match with Umaga. Great matches with Triple H, with Shawn Michaels. He had, for all the matches he had with Randy Orton, there were some really good ones in there, including the I Quit match at Breaking Point, I think it was. They had an Iron Man match that I thought was pretty good. Cena's had great matches with a lot of different people, including Punk and others as well, as he did with Brock Lesnar and The Rock at WrestleMania. And he doesn't get credit for it because people are tired of seeing him and because he's not a CM Punk. He's not a Bret Hart. He's not a Kurt Angle. So he gets shit for it. But you're absolutely right. John Cena, when he goes into the Hall of Fame, will have a tremendous resume of great matches under his belt. Nobody can deny that he's been involved in some great fucking matches. And if you deny that, you're burying your head in the sand and you don't know what wrestling is. So I think Valentino makes a hell of a point there. Does it matter how good a wrestler someone is? Well, it depends how over they are. You can be over with the crowd, but be a shitty goddamn wrestler. So I guess the answer to your question is no. At the end of the day, it really doesn't matter. Rayvon writes in with two questions. First, what was the main reason Kurt Angle left WWE back in 2006? Second question, was there legit heat between Ron Simmons and Ahmed Johnson? I remember in a shoot interview, Ron Simmons said that Ahmed always was a stiff wrestler and got away with injuring a lot of superstars. To take the last question first, Wouldn't surprise me if there was heat between the two of them. I don't know of any specifically, but I know that Ahmed Johnson was not a favorite person for people to work with when he was in WWE because he was a reckless guy. He was a nutcase in there. I mean, he would injure people. He would injure himself just as often as he would injure other people. I mean, it became comical after a while. He became so injury-prone. The storyline they did where I think he had a kidney injury. He got kicked in the kidney by Ron Simmons. Perhaps the heat stems from that because that was a legitimate injury. Now, I'm not sure if they did that to cover up what had already been a legitimate kidney injury, so they had him kick him there, or if he really did get the kidney injury from the kick, which if that's the case, then I can understand why there would be heat between the two of them. But Ahmed would come back from one injury, and in his first match back, he would suffer another one. I think that happened once, and he was on Raw his first match back, and he got his hand, I think, slammed on the steel steps and sliced his hand open, and just, you know, he was not somebody that people liked working with because he wasn't safe, if that answers your question. And the first question about Kurt Angle, he left in 2006 because he was crazy. He was on a death spiral. At least that's how WWE saw it. It takes a lot for WWE, particularly if you're a main event world champion level guy, main event guy, it takes a lot for WWE to actually agree to let you go. They basically let him out of his contract early and he went right to TNA. They would not do that with anybody else. And if they did let somebody go, they sure as hell would make sure that there was some sort of non-compete in place that would prevent that person from wrestling for TNA or any other wrestling company for at least a year. I guarantee you that. The fact they did not do that with Kurt Angle, there was a meeting that took place. Angle wanted out of his contract. And he tells different stories about what happened during the meeting. And Kurt Angle, more often than not, is full of shit. I love Kurt. And I've met him before, and I respect his work, and I think he's had some great matches, but he's full of shit. And you can't believe a word out of his mouth. The guy talks out of both sides of it. So Kurt has told different versions and variations of what happened in his meeting with WWE and has said that Vince wouldn't give him any time off, which I can actually believe that. But there was a meeting that took place. There were text messages that Kurt was sending to people at the time that didn't make any sense. What does that remind you of? Think about Benoit, not even 2 years. Think of Benoit the year after that, and the text messages he was sending to people. So Kurt was doing the same thing. He was just behaving in a very odd fashion. He was sending weird messages to people, and he was probably still all pilled up on drugs at the time and just in a very bad way. And WWE, I think, just wanted to cut bait and did not want him to be under contract, God forbid, if something happened to him. And they could see that this was going down a very bad road, and they let him go. And it was actually an indictment in a lot of ways on TNA at the time that they snatched him right up. Now, I can understand why they would want to snatch up a guy like Kurt Angle, but if you know the guy's got issues, let him work out his issues. Don't sign him to a contract right away and put him right back to work. But that's what TNA did. And Kurt Angle's been with TNA a lot longer than I ever thought he would be. You know, one time I was convinced, Kurt's gonna definitely be back in WWE. And I still believe he will be, but I'm not as sure now as I once was, because WWE has obviously not that they haven't had any interest. I did hear when Angle's contract was coming up a year or two ago that they were already planning ideas for him. But, Kurt is a guy that has been loyal to Dixie Carter and loyal to TNA. I don't know how much time he has left under his current deal. Like I said, I do think he will be back in WWE at some point, maybe not full-time, but he will be back. He will be in the Hall of Fame one day, and I hope he's alive. I really do. I hope he's alive and healthy enough to accept an induction into the Hall of Fame, because the way that he has treated his body, ever since he broke his neck in the Olympics in 96, the way that this guy has treated his body, it's a miracle he's still around right now. And that had a lot to do with why WWE let him go in 06. Last question here we'll get to this week comes from Craig. Have you ever been to England? Just thought I would ask. If not, are you ever planning to? I have never been to Europe at all, actually. I've been to Canada. I have been to Costa Rica. And I've been to many different states here in the U.S., including Oregon now. But I've never been overseas to Europe, and that includes England. I've heard good things about it. I've heard that everybody that I know that has been there has enjoyed it. And Paris and places like that as well. So I have not been there. I would love to go. I'm not planning on it at this point, but perhaps one day it will happen. And I know I have a lot of people in England and the UK who listen to this show. I don't know why such a dominant portion of the listening audience actually comes from there, but I am very thankful for your support, and perhaps you can shed some light. If I do decide to make the trek over there or for business or whatever, perhaps you can shed some light on places I should visit, things I should see while I'm over there, because I would be completely lost if I went over there and didn't know what to do. So perhaps you can help me out with that. That's going to do it for the mailbag this week. And as I said, yet again, if you have questions, you can email me. TheSolomonster@gmail.com is the quickest and most direct way to do so. Have a lot of other questions that I have not yet answered. I will try to get to that this week. You can follow me on Twitter, @Solomonster. Follow me on there. Friend me on Facebook as well, facebook.com/TheSolomonster. You'll see the Solomonster Sounds Off official logo as my profile picture. That is it. You can send me a friend request. I will approve you, and you can be part of all the action that goes on Facebook each and every week. And you can subscribe to the show in iTunes as well. Type in Solomonster Sounds Off. It'll come right up. You can subscribe. Anything that gets uploaded to the feed will automatically be downloaded for you, so you will be among the first to listen to the Sound Off each week. You could also leave a review. Leave some love for the Sound Off on iTunes. You can rate us on a scale of 1 star to 5 stars. You can leave some feedback. All of that only helps the show, so I appreciate that if you would be so kind. It's going to do it for episode 221 this week. I want to thank you all for tuning in. We'll be back next weekend as we approach the official start of summer coming up in a couple of weeks. We'll have episode 222 on the air next week. I'll be checking out Impact again this Thursday. I'm going to give them a shot. They left a good impression on me this week. Hopefully they can keep the ball rolling. And I'm sure John Cena will be back on Raw this week. If the ratings are any indication, I don't think we're going to have another Cena-free Raw for quite some time. I don't know if that's good or bad, but I expect him to be on the show this week. I guess we will see. So until next time, be well, stay safe. Thanks for tuning in, and we'll be right back here next week.
Let me tell you something, fella.
This is Joel from Northern Ireland.
Hi, I'm AJ Grimaldo.
And quite simply, the fastest 60 minutes on the internet.
The Solomonster Sounds Off on SEScoops.com.